Welcome, Archbishop Buti Tlagale. Is that
Thank
the
you.
right
That's
pronunciation?
correct,
Are
yes.
you Zulu?
I'm Tswana.
Are you Tswana? Okay, because I see you grew up in KwaZulu-Natal, if I'm not
No,
mistaken. Are
I just attended high school
you're 10?
there. Actually, I was born in Randfontein, in the West Rand. So that's where I grew up.
We are very honored to have you here today. Thank you. Now, there's so many things that we could speak about. South Africa is such an interesting country. It's seen huge changes. We've gone from the icon, Nelson Mandela, to the protege of the icon, Thabo Mbeki, and now we have
Jacob Zuma.
Zuma, who's quite recently been heading the country. What we'd really like to know is, where do you think South Africa is heading? It's a country of so many contrasts, so much poverty still today, and so much flashy richness. If you go to Johannesburg, Ferraris, Lamborghinis, villas, shopping malls. How can the nation reconcile, keep all this together and go forward? What do you think the path South Africa is on?
I very difficult, very complex, I guess. When we started off 14 years ago, there was a lot of hope. There is still hope, I think, but certainly not to the same level as there used to be. In many ways, I think we've kind of lost the moral high ground. That's probably a negative way of starting talking about South Africa. Lost the moral high ground because I think, for example, the level of crime in the country is very high. I think that corruption has sort of insinuated itself into our whole socio-economic political system. If you think about home affairs, you get a little bit depressed. We are member of the Commonwealth, but as it is, we've lost that privilege. We have to now get visas to get into England. Simply because of corruption at home affairs of people buying passports off the street. If you look at the newspapers almost every day, they are dominated by crime. The police are involved in drugs, the police are involved in taxes. That for me, this is symptomatic of actually losing the moral high ground. On the other hand, there is still this strong hope that things will turn around. The aspiration is still there, and people still feel that lots could be done. The last elections, the government got in on the basis on the promise that they will deliver services to ordinary people. Now, it is still too early. These are early days, so we can't really say whether they're really committed to it. But talking about losing moral high ground, even the Communist Party, if you look at their leaders with BMWs, you often wonder what socialism is all about. They've suddenly gone capitalist overnight. So one doesn't want to be very cynical, but that's the reality of South Africa. On the other hand, the government, Jacob Zuma, has promised a clean government, has promised to deliver, has set up a hotline to his office on delivery issues. There are still communities in South Africa that do not have electricity, that do not have running water, problems with sanitation and therefore electricity, etc. So they are saying, we've walked this road for the last 14 years. We see some people progressing, but the majority of us are still living in squalor, etc. That has to change. We see councillors making promises, getting fat pay car salaries, etc., corrupt and taking bribes, and they're not delivering services. This has to stop. And what one is also seeing, for me, the funny point is that is also a sign of hope. When ordinary people can rise and make demands about their rights, call government, call officials, councillors to account, that for me is a sign of hope. It means you
Absolutely.
will correct. The situation will be corrected in time. The government cannot ignore them. They burn tires on the streets, and the people go on strike on these issues. For me, that's the sign of hope. So, yes, in a sense, I say we're losing a moral high ground, but at the same time, you could never suppress the aspirations of a people for too long. They will rise, and that is what is happening.
Thank you. I know it was a very vast and difficult question to answer. So let's get back a little bit to the synod, which is ongoing. We have been asked here at the radio to speak about African issues as much as possible, to get them through the media, because the rest of the world, it seems, doesn't care, doesn't really care about Africa at all. I've just had the chance to glance at your intervention at the synod yesterday. You use some very strong words. You say the cultures of Africa are under heavy strain from liberalism, secularism, and from lobbyists who squat at the United Nations. Africa faces a second wave of colonization.
The reason for that is talking about, again, moral values. If we start with that one, the Maputo Protocol. African countries are being asked to sign that. Some have signed it. What it actually does, it sort of undermines the traditional moral values, but also undermines Christian values, where you can have same-sex unions, where you can, in a South African case, for example, where you have children as young as 14, they can have abortion without permission of their parents. The very idea of trying to say there is no marriage, we're actually talking about unions now. We're changing the whole idea of the way people think. That for us is a major concern. It means that here we are being invaded by a whole foreign way of looking at things. And therefore,
it's really imposing a philosophy that doesn't belong to the people.
That has never been part of the people, you see. I mean, we've had our own problems with polygamy and things like that. That's quite different. But here you are actually saying there's no marriage. Or if you talk about marriage, it is not what you used to understand as marriage. It's simply two persons, irrespective of their sex, who can actually stay together. And that's what marriage is supposed to be. But that's contrary to what we have known to be marriage. And we also see a threat. What about children in that context? You know, nobody actually clarifies the role. Where do children come from? And it has all sorts of social implications. So those are the things we are up against and saying this whole new culture, what they call the new global ethic, is contrary to our way of life as Africans, let alone as Christians. And there are lobbyists, people lobbying in at the United Nations for this. South Africa, unfortunately, has been caught in this already. It has passed these laws already in South Africa. We're caught in it, but other countries are still struggling. So we're saying as church, we need to be protecting not just Christian values, but we also need to be protecting traditional African values. Admittedly, they are not all that clean, sanitized from a theological or Christian viewpoint, but still, those values held communities together. And what you are doing now, you are destroying those communities. And we see that as a second wave of trying to colonize people and you by telling them how to live, instead of them coming up with their own ways of living. I guess related to that is a whole economic thing. I mean, Europe still wants to decide about markets. There's no free system of market. They are not protecting the weak in this situation. You have biofuel. If Africa were to sell maize and all their crops in order to make petrol, where would people end? And all these things are dominated by the West. And we feel that Africa, therefore, is under threat, not only on a moral basis, but also culturally and economically and politically. We don't count in world affairs, simply because even though we have resources, I mean, I hear at this conference everybody telling us about the resources of gold, of minerals, etc. And yet Africa is hungry. The children go starving. There's no medicine, poor health, no education. One of the major problems in Africa is simply in Angola during the 33-year war, more than 80% of the people moved into Luanda to run away from the rural areas because of war. But this is what you find in major African cities. People have moved from the rural areas in order to eke a living with the hope of being able to get opportunities in the urban areas. We see this also in South Africa. So I'm saying that even though you might say Africa has minerals, Africa does not have the know-how of converting those minerals into money, into creating jobs, into... So in a sense, we still look up to the West to help us with the know-how. One of the major things which Africa needs to do, which we're not doing very well, is simply educate the nation and give the nation a good health. Then they'll take care of themselves. But that's not happening yet.
Do you think the church can have a role in... in changing this negative
we are saying that if the bishops mean what they say, we've not come here together just to complain about the problems of Africa, but if our regional episcopal conferences and if our continental conference, SECAM, if all these bodies were strong in implementing the resolutions of the synod, if we spoke with one voice across our regions, across the continent, we would be able to lean on the political leaders. They would, because we have people, we are speaking on behalf of so many people, they would feel the obligation to listen. But in order to do that, we've got to put our own house in order.
So you're doing a real self-critique here.
Absolutely. If we don't do that, we will go back home and we'll moan about the situation and not be able to do anything about it. I say, if, for example, we all agreed, think about the Maputo Protocol. If we went back and told our governments we disagree with this on the basis of, and actually mobilize people and say we disagree with this, support us on this, government would reconsider. If we go back and say to government, we think education is a right, and not just in one country, but we would like you to see, we know you don't have all the money to educate the entire nation, but we would like to see a firm commitment on your part to provide free education at one level or another, and persistently do that throughout the sub-Saharan continent. I think we can get it. We can get away with it. It's very interesting. In South Africa, education, the state has taken over, even though we have private schools. In other African countries, private schools are still flourishing because the state hasn't taken over education. They don't have the means to do so. But where they have the means, I think they could be persuaded to say, this is a number one priority. I'm convinced that education is your number one priority. If people are educated, they will do what they want. You cannot be educated and go hungry. You've got your head, you've got your hands, what more do you want? You know, so we could actually collectively, across borders, convince our governments to bring about change, or even support them in some of the more positive initiatives that they are taking.
It's a big responsibility.
It is.
You also have another responsibility, I think. You, the people of Southern Africa, you have a major humanitarian disaster on your doorstep, which is Zimbabwe. And I think yours have been one of the only voices raised throughout these past few years. Mm-hmm. Since Tsvangirai and Mugabe signed the agreement for the unity government, we've never heard of Zimbabwe again.
That's true. It's amazing. And yet, very little progress, I gather, has been made. Very little progress. I'm not very sure, you know, our campaign was that Mugabe should be forced out of power. But some of the Zimbabweans, of course, they think differently. They say, if you do that, there's going to be chaos. You know, ZANU-PF is going to be killing people. And we have the opinion that until such time Mugabe leaves that area, you are not going to get any investments coming. The country will remain as stagnant as it is. There will be no change. You know, Mugabe has become the stumbling block. Certainly as far as the West is concerned, they're not going to give money to... People are not dumb. Even if you say you invest in that country, if it's going to go through government, the ZANU-PF is going to gain, and they're not going to allow that. So Mugabe is still very much amazing that an individual can become such a huge stumbling block.
I feel so, as a church and as a Christian and as just an ordinary, decent person, to stand by and watch what is happening to that people, I find it so difficult.
We've argued with the bishops here in the past, say, Mugabe is a Catholic. Let's excommunicate him. Doesn't matter the consequences. We can debate. Excommunicate him. Of course, their problem is they are concerned about the repercussions. They're on the situation, and the pro-Mugabe group might want to be more violent and things like that. So they're preoccupied, and those preoccupations are real. One does not want to underestimate it. But on the other hand, if you don't take any risk, you don't get very far. And if we've identified Mugabe as a stumbling block, then deal with the stumbling block, and not hope that someday he's going to fall ill.
Absolutely.
This man has good health. God has given him good health.
He had a big birthday party.
Yes, it's unbelievable, but Zimbabwe is not making any progress at all.
It's really, I find it so tragic.
And I would say, I don't know, we don't get the real statistics. I just know from Johannesburg that we've got thousands of Zimbabweans in Johannesburg who slip on the streets. And that's intolerable. You cannot tolerate such a situation. So it's become our problem as South Africans.
Well, I read there are 3 million Zimbabweans in South Africa.
I'm sure there are. It's just that we don't, because they are always on the move, we don't have, we can't tell how many there are there. But I'm convinced that there certainly are, certainly around Johannesburg, a million would certainly be a number.
Yeah. Now, you, Archbishop, you're obviously a man who has at heart the affairs of your nation and of the whole of Africa and your area, obviously. Do you feel isolated in your fight, in your work, or do you feel not supported?
Not really. One goes around, certainly in Johannesburg, and talking about Zimbabwe, for example, there was a time when each time we go around different communities and talked or preached about Zimbabwe, you'd be amazed at how many people are actually Zimbabweans, both white and black, and would come and say, look, we've lost the farm, this and this. And when you hear ordinary people coming to you after Mass and talking, then you know that you are not wrong. You are not on the wrong track. It would be nice to do if we could do better than that, if we had a way. And one also knows that certainly in terms of we've been to Zimbabwe so many times, talking to people there and their anxiety and concerns, etc. So we know we're on the right side. We should be doing more. We should be doing more. So no, one doesn't really feel that much isolated on this because there are people out there. Just that the amazing part is that there are so many of us and yet we're so paralyzed. That's the sad aspect of it.
Do you think the media has a role in building peace in Africa?
I tell you, in South Africa, the reason why South Africa has not yet collapsed is because the media is keeping the government on its toes. I have no doubt about that in my mind. The whole Zuma struggle, for example, over 7-8 years when he was first accused, this has been kept in the limelight by the media. The corruption that's going on in government, in the civil service, and any of these things, it's the media that's keeping the community informed, that's keeping the government on its toes, holding them to account. So the media has a huge role to play. There is no question about that. Once the voice of the media disappears, then you have dictators emerging, then you have your whole country sliding into, into very lower levels of corruptions and abuse of power, etc. So the media has a great role to play. And that is why in Zimbabwe, for example, when they were critical of Mugabe simply banned the newspapers.
Absolutely.
So I have no doubt that communication today, the media, is one powerful tool of a Poland democracy.
Also the international media may be bringing the real issues of Africa to the rest of the world.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes.
What is your hope that the synod may create? Or you're going to go back to South Africa. What do you think people in South Africa want to hear from you?
I don't know. I guess we're probably at slightly different expectations. My expectation of the synod is that we will speak in one voice, be a visible leadership across boundaries, select one or two or three things we want to put up a fight about, and do it, and seek to achieve results. That's what I would like to see happening myself.
Like managers.
I would like to see a committed leadership, a collective leadership, an accountable leadership.
You said something interesting. You said the unpleasant challenges of leadership.
Unpleasant in the sense that most, when these things come up, when we fear reaction from the people we criticize and we want to back away. And also, if you take, for example, the example of Pius Ncube, look what has happened to him. It could happen to any of us. So when you challenge the leaders, political leadership, with all the might they have, they might actually turn around and make your life impossible. So by virtue of being in a position of leadership, you have access to a certain level of support of the people by virtue of that position of responsibility. But people also expect you to take certain risks. And it is those risks that I'm referring to, that they can be very unpleasant, some of those challenges. And we have to be stand up and be counted. If we did that together, obviously in our situation at times we have to do that as individuals where we are concretely, but as a country, for example, we've got to do that as a collective, so too across the region. I mean, if you look at SADC, mm-hmm. the political level, mm-hmm. we've got SADC, and then we've got the AU at a continental level. Even politicians feel the need of working together at those levels, so too the church. You know, we've got to work together. If we succeed in doing that, in having a common commitment, then we will be able to produce results. We won't just make claims. We'll be able to follow through on the promises we make to the people we serve. Our job is simply to serve communities. And if they feel oppressed, deprived, we've got to speak on their behalf. And if we do that without fear, without favor, then we will be doing our job. So I think in many ways the expectations are that since you claim to be leaders, or we've put in position of responsibility, behave like leaders and help us, help alleviate the pain, the poverty, the stress of the people. That's what we're called to do.
Thank you very much. Just one last thing. You've been at the synod 3-4 days now.
Yes.
What is your feeling about this synod? How's it going?
So far it's going very well. I'm afraid in 8 days it might be different. So far,
why do you say that?
So far it's going very well because you actually begin to have a sense of the concerns of the church in different parts of Africa. We just had just before lunch one of the sisters there who was making an input that she had actually, during the Tutsi,
the Rwanda genocide.
Burundi genocide,
mm-hmm.
and she was jailed, her parents were killed, and she was narrating a story how she actually met the person who killed the parents, how he embraced him in forgiving him, and she felt relieved about that. So you hear these painful stories which people have lived through. And so far it's very good to hear all that, the oppression, etc. And hopefully we'll be able to pull all that together and say, where do we go to from here? We've had all these sad, painful, heartbreaking stories. It shouldn't end there. Our job should be, how do we ensure that stories like that do not happen again? And how do we cooperate, negotiate with political leaders, economic leaders, to make sure that they also, as leaders, live up to expectations and do what they've promised? And so that will be our challenge. So that's what I would hope that the Synod would be able to having experienced, as it were, vicarious experience, the pain of others, that would be able to sit down and say, okay, we've had all that. Now this is our plan. This is what we're going to do next 5, 6, 10 years.
Until the next Synod, at least.
Until the next Synod. But in order to do that, you know, it is not that Synod.
Sure.
It should be our own, as I said, our own conferences that should be strong and work on this thing on an ongoing basis.
You seem to have a pretty strong group.
No, I'm confident that we will come out with something, and we will try. If we don't do that, I think there will be we would be ashamed the next time we come around. We would be ashamed of saying we came here and talked loud and did nothing. You know, so in so doing, we would be betraying the people who have put so much trust in us.
Thank you very, very much, Archbishop Bhuti. No, is there anything else you would like to say that we haven't mentioned? There's so much one can say, but
I can't think of any. But I you know, Africa has gone through this, I guess, couple of generations have gone these difficult times, and you have young people growing up. I think we owe it to the children of Africa. If their parents have not had it good, we owe it to the children of Africa to prepare a better future for them. You know, so if we can do that much, if we can think along those lines and not think about the unhappy past of wars, of racism, of segregation, of deprivation, and say, we've known that, we've lived through it, how can we ensure a secure future for the children of Africa of tomorrow? We would have done something.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much.